Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 385 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 20th of July, 2018, as I record this. So today I'm talking to paramedic Samantha Keel about how to write effective injuries for your characters, which I find obviously a very interesting discussion. We talk about bond and reacher, and we talk about some of the ethics of representation. And what is really interesting is we also talk about the trans community, because Sam is a trans woman. Now, I have to confess, I am 43, and I think a lot of millennials are a lot more au fait with a lot of this, but I have been trying to educate myself more around trans issues. And those of you who watch Queer Eye on Netflix, which is just an awesome program, they have an episode with one trans man. And I've also been reading a lot more. So this is such an interesting discussion, and we talk about lots of different things. But it's fascinating as writers, because I feel like we need to understand words and labels that people are given, and also self-identity. So I feel like this discussion with Sam goes into all kinds of different levels of interesting things around both our own self-identity, but also the self-identity of our characters. And that might not necessarily match how society sees us or labels us. And again, as writers, I think we need to understand language, and we need to understand what words mean to different people and how language can imprison people. So I hope you find this discussion interesting on many levels. But first, quite an extended introduction. I have lots of things to be talking about. So into publishing news, a few very interesting developments this week. And it's so funny, I was thinking about this. You think we are stable, you think the community is stable and we know what's going on. And then things just keep happening that that turn things in different ways. So first of all, Ingram Spark have announced personalization on print-on-demand books. So you can personalize any order for $1 per book. So think about this. You can add an additional page of content that you want per book on the first page of the book. All other orders of the book will remain unchanged unless you add the personalization. You can do one-off dedications. So for example, you might do a giveaway. A giveaway winner might have a personalized front page. You might have a letter to readers. So maybe there's a book club order that you might do, or we had Dave Hendrickson on talking about ordering books for schools. You could have a front piece which talks about the school, or might have questions for a book club to discuss. You could also commemorate an occasion. So if you're speaking at an event, maybe you want key talking points or the links to a slides or different things. Some really good options there with Ingram Spark. So you can just, when you order, it says simply click personalize it when placing your next order. So I think that's fascinating. And I do think that with print, we are getting into this period of time when print, I mean, I've personally found more and more of my sales are print. And actually next week, I'm going to talk to you about my last tax year. I've done all those figures now, or at least I had a wonderful VA do my figures, and I'll be talking about that next week. Thanks, Russell. And I'll be talking about Russell next week too. But basically, this is very interesting. Another version of print on demand, another thing we can do to make things more special for readers. So that's cool. Second thing, Publish Drive have signed a contract with Dang Dang, China's largest ebook seller. With 66% of Chinese adults using their phones to read, this opportunity opens new doors for indie publishers. And I am really fascinated by this. I have met with Publish Drive a number of times, and Kinga will be coming on the show at some point to talk about Publish Drive. But because they are, they're now in a Google incubator, so they are sort of being mentored, but they come out of Hungary, and having this sort of different international view to digital is fascinating, I think. And they're also able to get into places that potentially American-centric companies are finding more difficult. So very interesting. There's an article in Publishing Perspectives all about Publish Drive and Dang Dang. But I do have some books on Publish Drive. I'm going to do more with Publish Drive because I think they are really getting, and I use, so just to be clear, these things change all the time, right? But I go direct to KDP. So Amazon KDP, Kobo Writing Life, and also to iBooks. So I use iTunes Connect to go to iBooks. I use Drafter Digital for a number of other things, including Nook. And I use Publish Drive primarily for Google Play, but I'm now looking, obviously, they have lots of other ebook sellers as well. So this is fascinating. So that's Publish Drive. The next thing, I mean, this is really going off this week. The next thing is that ACX, which is the audiobook creating, so kind of audiobook self-publishing service, I guess, where you can find narrators and license your rights to ACX to distribute to Audible, Amazon and iTunes. So ACX has increased their bounty from $50 to $75 per referral after 1st of August 2018. And what this is the referral to get more Audible subscribers. This is fascinating. And many authors are making money with bounties. So this is like an affiliate sale, basically. But they are now, so this is essentially paying $75 per audiobook listener that you recruit into their system. Now, most of us want to advertise our audiobooks anyway, but this is a way you can advertise your audiobooks and get bounties. So, and you will now, after August the 1st, be able to access specific referral links on your ACX sales dashboard. This is still only relevant to some authors in some countries because ACX, I think it's US, UK, Canada, Ireland. They might have expanded it, but it's certainly not open to everyone. But I find this fascinating because this is stepping up aggressive growth. This is recruiting loads more people to essentially push their books out and try and get more audiobook listeners. So I do that anyway, but this makes it more attractive. So fascinating push for ACX there. And then finally, in this publishing news segment, a really interesting article posted by Richard Charkin, who's been a publisher in the UK for many years. He has written this on Publishing Perspectives again. And this is a sort of a list of questions that Richard has for publishers. And I think it's really fascinating because it gives an insight into some industry practices that many authors are unaware of, or they, if they're traditionally published, they're aware of them and they don't really understand them either. What this article does is say, well, maybe we don't understand it either. He basically says, why is publishing so complicated? Some of the questions he raises, and I won't read it all, but I'll link to all of this in the show notes. He says, why do publishers allow retailers to return unsold stock? Why does it generally take approximately 1 year between final manuscript submission and publication? Why do the largest advances against royalties go to the authors who need the money the least, and vice versa? Why is a book handled on average 20 times between manufacture and purchase and sale? Why are author contracts and royalty statements so impenetrably hard to understand? The current industry standard, at least in English language trade book publishing, is wasteful and pointless. Why do publishers continue to print too many copies when digital and print on demand make it possible to use print on demand? Yes, the immediate cost might be higher, but the write down costs of stock in our industry remain horrendous.
And finally, seriously, there's this whole list of questions. It's fascinating. Why do publishers make available their least affordable format, hardback, at the time of maximum publicity exposure and then issue the affordable paperback when there's less exposure? So it's so fascinating that a very established publishing figure here in the UK is asking these questions, and it gives us hope that there's some questioning going on in the industry as to how they can cut their costs around things and make things better, I guess, for authors. Okay, so that's publishing, and now my personal update. Well, to be honest, it's been a bit of a big week. I feel quite discombobulated at the moment. I'm going through I was reading an article by Brené Brown about the sort of unraveling that can happen at these various points in our life. And I was revisiting what was kind of going on with my publishing world. And obviously I do too much. As I've said before, don't do what I do. Try and focus more. And I really had a sort of moment when I was looking at everything and I can't do it all. I really can't. Something has to give. And as I've mentioned before, I'm not giving this up. I'm not giving up the podcast. So that's one thing. There's the Joanna Penn nonfiction, my JF Penn fiction, which is kind of what I really want to be. And then there's Penny Appleton, which I co-write with my mum. And so I had a big meeting with my mum this week. And many of you followed this journey, and we had a very big meeting. We had like 5 hours. We did go out for breakfast, but we had a big, big talk together, and we've decided to wind up Penny Appleton and no longer write together. So I can imagine you listening can understand the angst underlying this sort of decision. I obviously love my mum desperately, and I have spent now nearly 2 years helping her become a writer. We did 3 books together. I helped her with another nonfiction book. She has definitely emerged from the mess of what happens when you first decide to write a book to understanding how to finish a book. But at the end of the day, I am not the right partner for her for many reasons. It's like, should you teach your kids to drive? Or, you know, should you really work with your husband, which I do? You know, there are lots of things where working with family, and I've helped my dad write a book. I've done a colouring book with my dad. I run the business with Jonathan. I am very enmeshed with my family, who I love very much. But my mum, my mum is writing romance, which I'm not a romance writer. And I really have to just knuckle down and do that. And I'm not an editor either. I have no wish to be an editor, and I'm not a good editor for her. I'm not a good co-writer for her. And she needs to go forth and do her thing, write her voice. And also, I've stifled her voice. And it was really interesting when I reviewed some of my notes, because I did spend a lot of time at the beginning of the week kind of on her latest manuscript. And the notes that I came up with, I realised that I would not accept those notes from an editor. I just wouldn't accept them because they were not respectful of my voice and an editor's job, a good editor. And of course, I, recently had Natasha on from New York Book Editors. I've had lots of editors on the show. Editors do an amazing job of turning a writer's voice into a better polished finished product, but their job is never to stifle a writer's voice. But because I was a co-writer with Penny Appleton, because I am many years ahead of my mum, which is awful to kind of say, but I've been doing this now, I've been writing now for 12 years, 10 years in my company, and I've written a lot of books. So what was happening is I was just stifling her voice. Plus, I don't have the time to do the projects I want to do. So the upshot of that is I am no longer doing Penny Appleton. Penny Appleton will remain as a 3-book writer. Mum will continue writing and take the books that she already has partially written and planned and publish them under another name. I will not be publishing them. Curl Up Press will not be publishing them. I will be returning to what I love and what I'm good at. So Mum has actually agreed to come on the show and talk about this. So that will be really interesting. We haven't decided on a date yet, but hopefully it will be in the next couple of months so that you can all hear her perspective. And I want her to talk about what she's learned, because she's really gone from someone who literally, she was one of those people who would say, oh yeah, when I have the time, I'll write a book. And now she has a great respect for how difficult the process is. So lots of lessons learned. We all move on, closing a chapter. And I am really happy to have another part of my brain back to dedicate to my fiction, which is very cool. So yes, I will now be knuckling down, and I am back on Valley of Dry Bones and really just intent on finishing that draft in the next month. So really, I'm just scheduling a lot of time. What I do now with my, if I want to really get a first draft done, so I do my couple of hours at the cafe, go and do some exercise, some movement. And then in the afternoon, I do another couple of hours at a co-working space. I just find that actually booking and paying for a room at a co-working space is not that expensive. But, you know, it just gives me, if I go in that room and I've paid for it, I better bloomin' work. And it helps me separate my my projects. So that will, I am really knuckling down on that now and excited to finish that. Right. And also, oh yes, we've been up in Edinburgh this week in Scotland. My brother and his wife live up there. So having a look at the city from a slightly less touristy perspective. I've done on Edinburgh a number of times, but we were looking around different areas and just had a good time. And also, I was excited to find my books in the Big Blackwells bookstore, How to Market a Book, in the writing section. And actually, it was face out and there were about six of them, I think. I've put a picture on Twitter pointing at them, but that was pretty cool. And I wanted to mention it because I didn't ask them to stock that book. The only reason I think it's there, well, the only reason it's there is because they can get it on discount on Ingram Spark. So if you want your books to be available in bookstores, you need to discount them. So the bookstores will never buy them from CreateSpace or KDP Print because they're not discounted. Whereas Ingram Spark, you can do a discount. So also, I have spoken in Scotland a number of times, and I'm also using Amazon advertising to target some of the books they also had in their in that section, in the writing section. So yeah, really cool to see a whole stack of my books in face out in the book display in a big store. So very cool. Okay, so useful stuff. This is primarily for Christian writers. For those of you who want to learn from an established best-selling Christian writer, Jerry B. Jenkins, who co-wrote the Left Behind series. And I had Jerry on the show in episode 334 because the Left Behind series really shaped my teenage years and still influences my writing today. Jerry has written over 150 books. He is prolific. He's won awards. He's, you know, multi-bestselling. I mean, the Left Behind series has sold so many copies. It's utterly ridiculous. But he, I'm actually reading one of his books right now called Valley of Dry Bones, which made me laugh. Mine will be very different, but yeah, quite cool to see he has one too. So Jerry has a course on writing, which is open at the moment. You can go to thecreativepen.com/Jerry, spelled J-E-R-R-Y. And this is only open for a short time. And yes, I am an affiliate of Jerry's course. I think he's a very generous and excellent teacher. He also has an incredible work ethic and writing talent, but in that he's been writing so long and he writes so many books, it's kind of past the point of talent. And that's why I say about his work ethic that I really respect that. So, but yes, I am an affiliate. So if you are interested in buying the course, I do receive a small percentage of the sale if you want to purchase, but at no extra cost to you. So you can definitely check that out. So writing course by Jerry B. Jenkins, go to thecreativepen.com/Jerry, J-E-R-R-Y. And if you are a Christian writer or reader, you will definitely know of him. I mean, the course is definitely appropriate for people who are not Christians, but I just thought, since he wrote the Left Behind series, that many of you I know will be interested. Right, thanks for all your emails and tweets this week. Amy Draper says, listening to the podcast on my way to my first Romance Writers of America conference, RWA, and I hear it was a good one, or it still is on, I guess, as I'm recording this. So very cool. Hope you have a good time. L. Danvers says, as always, fascinating, fantastic interview. I was so excited when I heard you were interviewing Stephen Pressfield. I never would have had the courage to hit publish if I hadn't read The War of Art. I recommend it to everyone. And I literally have pulled out Turning Pro again and put it on my desk because of this discombobulation I'm going through right now. There are so many reasons. This 10-year mark is really shaking me up a bit, I think. But anyway, in Turning Pro, Steve talks very much about the professional, and I haven't got it in front of me, I'm just doing this from memory, but he said, the professional's life is simple. And that's what I need to come back to. And maybe you do. If you're feeling overwhelmed, discombobulated, like you have way too much to do, Turning Pro, the professional's life is simple. And rescheduling things around simplicity, which is do the work. Margarita Morris said, love the podcast, thought of you when visiting this cemetery in Sighișoara, Transylvania, birthplace of Vlad the Impaler. The inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula, sent me a picture of a graveyard. Thank you, Margarita. And yes, I always love pictures of graveyards. Very much appreciate that. And just a couple more here. Sperry Editorial says, great Stephen Pressfield interview. He doesn't blog for others. He says, I do it almost to teach myself and to explore. I've had a hard time blogging for fear I don't yet have much to teach. Thinking of it as teaching myself may be the right mindset. Absolutely. And blogging definitely doesn't have to be teaching, not at all. And I will be getting back into my JF Penn website and really looking at content marketing for fiction. So I'll talk about that another time. But yeah, I always say, like, people say, oh, is blogging still worth doing? And I'm like, Stephen Pressfield blogs. So yeah. And finally, Marion says, excellent podcast. I've read The War of Art and Turning Pro and will buy The Artist's Journey today. It's so nice to hear a writer of his stature discuss writing from the inside out instead of outside in. As great as the indie publishing movement has been over the past decade, there seems to be more of a focus about writing from outside in. And I actually disagreed with Marion in comment because I feel like, yes, a lot of us talk about the publishing and marketing discoverability side in these type of shows, but I also talk about the craft a lot. My JF Penn site is all about the inside out stuff. I think most writers are still writing inside out. I don't think most writers write to market at all. I think that there are some hacking type ways of doing things, which is what I said at the front of the Pressfield interview, but I feel fundamentally we are still writing from inside out. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Covo Writing Life, and I will play a word from them in a minute. Thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Kristin Morin and Mike Stop Continues. And thanks to Jack Schaefer and Anita Renahan for increasing their pledges. And I really do appreciate your support on Patreon. Like the tweets and emails, it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And remember, you get the extra audio and other little bits and bobs of audio. I'm just about to put another extra out. So you can give just a couple of dollars a month to support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/ The Creative Pen. Right, here's a word from our sponsor and then we'll get on with the interview.
Creative Pen listeners, I'm Chrissy, the director of Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free self-publishing platform created by writers for writers.
And I'm Stephanie, and I work on our publisher operations team for KWO. And together, we are the Kobo Writing Life podcast. Do you want to get your books into hands of readers all over the world?
Do you want to work with a company and self-publishing team that care about you and want to help you succeed?
Anytime you need help, a real person from our team will get back to you within 2 days.
If you have feedback, we use it to make KWL even better. Just recently, we added sales report and payment history right in the dashboard under my account to make tracking those details even easier.
And we're currently in the process of revamping the dashboard with analytics based on comments from authors like you.
Yeah, your fingerprints are all over this thing.
So for more tips and tricks for self-publishing, check out the Kobo Writing Life podcast.
We are Kobo Writing Life. We want to help you achieve your dreams.
Visit us today at kobo.com/writinglife.
Today, I'm here with Samantha Keel. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Joanna. How are you today?
I am good. It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Samantha Keel is a 911 and critical care paramedic and has spent the last 10 years working in emergency medicine. She's also a medical consultant for writers, running the Script Medic blog, and has written brilliant books, including Blood on the Page, Maim Your Characters, and also writes LGBT speculative fiction. But before we get into it, Sam is just going to give a little disclaimer before we get into the interview.
Yeah, so I just wanted to let everybody know, okay, nothing in this podcast that we're discussing is going to be medical advice, okay? So if something winds up coming up that you either see later or that relates to something that you have, seek actual medical counsel. Don't try to treat yourself or anyone else using anything you find on this podcast. We will laugh at you and also have nothing to do with what you have decided to do with your life, okay? So...
This is just a podcast interview. So, but we have to say that to just make it clear to everyone. So very cool. So Sam, tell us a bit more about you and how you got both into emergency medicine and writing, and like, how do you manage them both?
So I started writing when I was very, very young. I'm one of those kids who just grew up with books upon books upon books. My mother's an editor. So there were always just this wealth of amazing stories around growing up. And I always wanted to write and create them. And I think the first story that I ever wrote, I was probably 5, 6, 7 years old, somewhere in there. And in terms of healthcare, I actually got lost on my way to medical school. I was in college. I was looking to head into, down the pre-med track and towards becoming a doctor. And I wound up taking 21 credits, working 2 jobs, and wound up dropping out of school. And the career I fell into after having done that while I was trying to get myself together was EMS. And I found that, the educational style for EMS is very much attuned to what I enjoy and the kind of learning that suits me. And but I never really gave up the writing passion. And back in 2016, the two sort of bumped. I was sitting in the parking lot outside of work one day, and I was like, huh, you know what there isn't out there is a resource for writers to accurately write about medical processes. Because, you see all these things on ER and you read them in books and see them in Bond movies and stuff like that. And none of it is real. All of it has this patina of being perfected for the story. And so I wanted to create a resource for writers that gave them the opportunity to at least understand the reality of things so they know where they're breaking the rules and how they can leverage the reality of, not just injuries, but medical issues as well, and really bring them into their stories in a way that supports the reader and respects people who go through things like that in their own lives. So I really wanted to create that resource. And it was kind of crazy because I started it as a Tumblr account, and inside of a week I had encouragement from none other than Neil Gaiman, which blew my mind.
Wow.
Yeah. I was totally blown away. Inside of a year writing, I want to say 2,100 blog posts, writing 3 books. And on top of that, I had a full-time job and a part-time job. So, I don't recommend people do that. It doesn't always work. But that's sort of how I got where I am.
Yeah, wow. And just to be clear, you're here under a pen name, and and this is probably advice for anyone who works in medicine, right? Is to keep your real, in quotation marks, self away from your writing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's, it's tough because you want to be as authentic as you possibly can and bring your truth out into the world. And at the same time, we live in such a litigious society and in such a way we're all extremely vulnerable. And, you know, trying to talk about this without, you know, opening myself up to, you know, potential liability has been really one of the hardest pieces, one of the hardest lines to walk.
Yeah. And, but I think how you've done it is absolutely what we recommend, you know, to anyone who feels like it's either self-censor yourself and don't help people, you know, which is what you're doing with your books, or you're putting yourself out there under a pen name. And I think we're, you know, the acceptance of pen names has become quite, you know, I think it's there, right? I mean, everyone's like, oh, right, it's a pen name. Like, I have friends I don't even know their, well, I do know their real names, but I still call them by their pen names. I mean, I think we all exist in this space now.
Yeah, for sure. And I think a lot of that has to do with the rise of internet culture, where, you know, people in my generation, we made friends with people online who we only knew by an internet handle. And so, you know, even something that looks like a traditional name is closer than we have. But some of the friendships that we make online are more real than the people we meet in real life, because we connect on, you know, actual emotional levels, not just on, oh, you're in the same space as me. And I think that has driven in part the acceptance of pen names and the acceptance of, you know, that level of self-protection.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's get into the violence. So I want to start with, like you just mentioned, the emotional connection. And you see the effects of real violence and real accidents and real nasty things in the real world. And most writers never do. And we don't want to. We are not wanting to be part of violence. And yet we write so much of it. And many writers are obsessed with injury and death, certainly in the thriller genre that I write in, horror genre, and they're on TV, like Westworld, Game of Thrones. The level of violence now is, you know, some would consider a lot. I'm a nice girl and I like watching these programs and I like reading these books. So I need you to help me and everyone listening. Why are we so interested in violence? What is the attraction, I guess?
I mean, I think in part, you know, it's what drives us to any part of fiction. I think we're driven to violence because it's an urge that we all have on some level. We are all primates. We are all, you know, animals in the true sense of the word. And, you know, we all have spaces where we feel like our boundaries have been violated, and perhaps now more than ever with the prevalence of, you know, social media and all of these pieces coming into our world. I think first and foremost, violence is a response to feeling violated. And I think that's part of the fascination, is that, you know, you and I can't, you know, haul up and punch a Nazi in the face, but Indiana Jones can, you know, and in fact, that's the purpose of his character. And I think we enjoy that. And I think over the last maybe 30, 40 years, we've taken a lot of the glamour off of the top of any kind of storytelling, but particularly surrounding violence, where we're no longer looking at, you know, Humphrey Bogart punching a guy in the face once and they black out. We're now looking at, you know, somebody like Bond or like Reacher who can go out and just massacre entire towns and sort of walk away scot-free. And I think there's a danger in that, where we've divorced consequence from violence. But I think a lot of the grittiness that we see, I mean, that's what a lot of it comes down to. A lot of the violence that we see in storytelling is trying to be grittier and trying to feel more real. And I think what winds up happening in some cases is that things get cartoony. You know, we're exploring in part our own fantasies. We're exploring in part what would happen if, you know, in this world with no consequences and in this world with no rules, and, you know, exploring these different versions of our future. And we do that with all forms of storytelling. But I think this, above anything, is a piece of ourselves that we've repressed. And that's not saying that we shouldn't repress it. That's not in any way advocating for violence. But I think that's part of the reasoning that we're seeing so much of it, is that, to be honest, it's something that people wish they could do to some extent. And it's really kind of upsetting, only because I feel like there's an ethical connection that we have to make that a lot of creators don't.
Yeah, and I think we'll circle back to the ethics side of the representation, because I think that that's definitely important to talk about. But I like what you said about you know, the what we can't do ourselves. So often people feel like there's no justice, you know, and therefore someone like Reacher can go in and you know, can help do sort of rough justice in a way that we might not expect justice to really work. So I think you're right in that way, and it's kind of a cathartic experience. And also, I guess I think for someone like me, like my female character, Morgan Sierra, like there's many things about her that are like me, but she is ex-Israeli military and she can really hold her own in a fight. Whereas I went to Krav Maga and came away crying on my first session and never went back. I am just thought like a real wet when it comes to like pain. So, you know, that kind of cathartic expression of what we would love to be able to be or do, as you say, or righting wrongs, can be a real part of that. Would you say that we're kind of, that catharsis is part of it?
You know, absolutely. Catharsis is part of it. And, you know, you're absolutely right. We look to our heroes to be who we can't and to live these lives that we want to experience or that we're curious about. You know, and part of that is the hero's journey and, you know, taking a hard look at the dark night of the soul and climbing back up. And part of that is doing things that we wish we could do, whether that's, you know, doing Krav Maga or, you know, taking out a whole town of really bad people, whatever, yeah, whatever that is.
It is. And I mean, you mentioned Bond and Reacher, and I personally, I'm a real James Bond fan and I love all the Reacher books. And I think part of that, you know, and I write women of those type of characters, really. And you mentioned them in your fantastic free ebook, which is 10 medical tropes that need to die. So just, you know, come back on why Bond and Reacher are, you know, in a way they're fun violence, but why are they wrong in their portrayal of violence in terms of, I guess, cause and effect?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think the number one thing that those stories do is they break the chain of cause and effect. You know, every action should have a reaction. For something to matter in a story, we have to see a consequence of it. And, you know, I think The Guardian did a count either a couple years ago or fairly recently, and James Bond has killed over 360 people in the course of his career. You know, it's that's just out there. And yet, you know, we never, maybe in one of the last couple of movies, but we never saw him have any emotional consequence to that. That was always completely divorced. And the only thing that ever affected him was the fact that he keeps losing the woman he's in love with every single movie, which is its whole other issue. But I think, you know, the danger in that is that if you see something over and over and over again with no consequences attached, it's easy, especially when someone is younger or maybe doesn't necessarily have a complete understanding of how the world works for one reason or another. It's very easy to think, oh, you know, the movie, this is just how things are. And in reality, you know, things are very, very different. And I think as someone who sees the other side of it, both, you know, in the immediate and in the longer term, where, you know, I've met people who've been paralyzed by getting shot in the spine. I've met people who got punched in the face and were bleeding inside of their head and were probably going to die. Like, you can't walk into that situation and not appreciate that there is another side to things. And we, you know, nothing ever happens to Bond. Nothing ever happens to Reacher. As far as I know, I haven't seen every movie or read all of the books in the Reacher series, but they never have either an internal emotional consequence or an external judicial kind of consequence for those actions. And I think it weakens the effect of the violence in the story. And I think it weakens the chain of cause and effect in general. And the more we reinforce that standard in our storytelling, you know, the more dangerous that becomes. And this isn't to blame any individual writer or individual story. You know, this isn't to say that, oh my goodness, violent video games are going to make kids go out and shoot people. You know, those are not things that I believe. But at the same time, I think as content creators, now more than ever, we have a responsibility to be very cognizant of what we're writing and very aware of the messages that we're sending, because we live in a world where, you know, we're starting to hear the voices of marginalized people. We're starting to hear more and more from LGBT writers, from, you know, from communities of color, from, you know, traditionally marginalized groups. And more, I think we're able to draw a link between the way we talk about people or the way we talk about events in popular culture and the effect that that has on those marginalized groups and what that really does to a community. Where, you know, I think on my end of things, I stayed away from embracing my identity as a trans woman for a long time because I didn't have any popular, you know, any positive representations to latch onto. And I shunned my own community because I didn't have any context that that was a good thing to be. And it's fantastic to be in it. You know, I genuinely love who I am, but for a very long time, I didn't have that connection. And you can't walk in that without understanding the parallels.
Yeah. But it's interesting. And I listen to you talking about, so I've been learning a lot more about the trans community, which, you know, mm-hmm. I think it's really important that we understand, like you're talking about kind of the cause and effect of being human in one way, you know. And what I'm now thinking is I need a trans woman Bond type character, like the protagonist that is doing that shouldn't just be the white cis male. So, right. You know what I mean? I kind of want these strong characters who can be the same as Bond, to be all the different types of diverse people that we have. Do you see what I mean? Like I totally get that in one way we need to respect victims in some way, but I also, like, the part of me that loves the alpha hero wants the alpha heroes to be diverse. So does that make sense?
Oh, that makes absolute sense. And I think we need to see, you know, not just positive representation, but, you know, representation at all of any particular group, as long as those characters are treated as characters and not just as, you know, cutouts or stereotypes.
Yeah.
And exactly. As long as, you know, they are as nuanced as anybody else. So, you know, I would love to see a trans female James Bond type character and see her internal conflict and see her, you know, trying to contextualize the world that she's living in through that lens. And I always have questions in my own beliefs as to whether or not someone who's outside of the community can do a character like that justice. But I also don't believe that as Caucasian writers, we shouldn't include characters of color just because we haven't lived that experience. Because you wind up only writing Caucasian characters, and that sucks.
Exactly. So, and this is my point with diversity, and that people are people. And yes, there are challenges that different people in diversity face, but at heart, like the writing of the wrongs thing, you know, the kind of going out and blowing some town up, you know, that to me can be something that any character can do. So I really like this idea. I think it's but what you're saying is the cause and effect on both the character and also the victims who are involved.
Exactly. And, you know, just once I would like to see James Bond crack somebody over the head and then, you know, come back out of the room and see that person, you know, vomiting horribly in the corner, you know, like, legitimate consequence, you know, and, you know, people just, in most of these stories, people just fall down dead. And that's not the way people have that experience. I think if you want to look at, you know, a realistic character death, there's a great scene in Band of Brothers where somebody winds up crying for his mom. You know, and he's one of the heroes. He's one of the good guys. And he gets shot a couple of times and he's regressed into his childhood and he's crying for his mom on the battlefield. And I feel like, you know, that gives him much more authentic experience. Not that particular trope, but, you know, just appreciating consequences in general, and both in terms of the LGBT community, communities of color, what have you, and in terms of victims of violence and victims of assault, and just recognizing that actions have consequences for other people. It's not just that James Bond has saved the world. It's that he's left 360 families without a father or a husband or a wife, or that he's left 360 pairs of parents weeping over their child's coffin. Like that, even if they're bad guys.
It's interesting
exploring that space.
Yeah, I actually think Game of Thrones does it better because it has the scope of television series, I think, and episodic books, series books do this better because you actually have the time to go into some of these, the effects on the characters. I mean, Game of Thrones being a classic example where, someone kills someone else's child and then they go on that then spirals into other violence. I mean, we see that in a big scale, things like the Middle East and, the sort of spiral of everybody killing each other. But let's come back to the book, because I think what's interesting, you have lots of books, but in Maim Your Characters, for example, and this ties into what you're saying, you talk about writing injuries that matter, that can actually help the plot. So when we're talking about stuff, it's normally plot, stuff happens, someone gets shot or something, but you're kind of arguing that there are injuries and things that can happen that can actually improve your plot and characterization. So how can we do that?
Oh, sure. So I think the key to doing that is just understanding the structure of an injury plot and weaving it into your overall narrative, right? So for example, I'm just going to go really quickly through the phases of an injury plot as I see them, as I broke them down in the book, and, sort of go through it. So, there's... First of all, somebody has to have, and it's very similar to the overall structure of a story. So somebody has to have an inciting injury, right? They break their leg, they fall off a horse, whatever it is. You have sort of the immediate phase of how they respond to that in that moment, what it means. So for example, maybe the hero is going after the villain, but the sidekick falls off his horse. And all of a sudden now the hero has to make a choice between helping his friend versus going after the villain. Right. Now you've added a question, you've added a moral element to the story of, am I the person who is so dedicated to justice that I'll abandon my friends versus am I the person who is so dedicated to my friend that I will let the bad guy get away? So you have that, and that's sort of what you would see as the beginning. And then, we're going to see you need some form of a definitive treatment. So if there's, a splint on the battlefield, you should, even if it's implied later on, you should have either a surgery or something else to definitively fix the problem. And then, you can watch these characters try to recover. And what I call the rocky road to recovery is you can use it as an exploration of the injured character. So many of these characters that we use, that we have as heroes, are very dependent on who they are in their role. So, for a long time, I defined myself as a paramedic. And there were a couple of times in my career where I got hurt and I didn't know who I was when I wasn't out there on an ambulance helping people. And answering that question has, gave me a lot of insight into myself. But from a storytelling perspective, you get a chance to see, who somebody becomes when they can't take that role originally. They can't take the role that they had wanted to. And then, there are a couple of optional pieces. You can choose to test them towards the end. So, for example, is the hero going to go after, the villain at the big showdown on their half-healed broken leg? Is that what they're going to do, or, something like that? And you can choose to settle them out at their new normal, where they either have some kind of lingering disability, they go back to the way they were, or they have a re-injury where you can, have them in the climax, have the bad guy stomp on that broken leg and double the pain and bring them back to that point. You may choose to do something different because it can be a little bit repetitive to use the same injury over and over again. Mm. But the bottom line is, you know, an injury plot forces you to examine A, who a character sees themselves as and how they cope with not being physically able to do the things they want to. And then B, you know, they can be a really interesting way to, you know, force a hero to approach a problem in a different way. So, you know, let's say you're writing a Lord of the Rings style book, and the only person who can open the doors to Mount Moria are the wizard. And the wizard literally gets taken out at the knees. Now your hero has to deal with a challenge in a different way, and they have to, you know, divert what they're doing or get more resourceful. So in terms of revelation of character, I think that's really where the money's at, is looking at how people respond when either they can't be themselves or they have to choose between, you know, their friends and their mission.
I really like that. And I think I certainly feel like I probably reach for obvious injuries. You know, we've seen so many films where people are shot, but they're shot in their shoulder, so it doesn't stop them.
Don't get me started on that.
Well, I did. I want to ask you. So, what are the? I mean, you have that in the tropes that need to die, I think. But what are some of the things that it kind of implies lazy writing, as in stop reaching for stuff that is just obvious?
I think you started with a good one. I think hitting a character, you know, shooting a character in the shoulder. First of all, people don't tend to understand what that the word shoulder actually means in terms of the anatomy. So, you know, if you want a character to have a nothing gunshot, you know, the outer flesh of the upper arm, the outer flesh of the thigh is probably what you want to reach for as a writer. But once you have something in or next to the rib cage, as a medical professional, that just takes me out of a story immediately, is that, you know what, any gunshot in the chest is a life threat until it's proven otherwise, has the potential to kill a character. And, you know, if you want to go for that trope and you want to shoot somebody in the shoulder, that's fine. Have it mean something. Have it threaten their life. Have their lung collapse. Have them bleed into their chest, whatever it is. Right. And then walk through the process of having a chest tube put in, draining out the chest. You know, the 2 or 3 weeks they're going to be walking around with a chest tube attached to their side of their chest with a drain. You know, I think in terms of some other tropes that sort of need to go away, I think the biggest one is the myth of the one-hit knockout, where, you know, a character decides to knock out a bad guy in lieu of killing them and tries to make the ethical choice. But what we don't see are the consequences of doing that in and of itself. So, you know, it's entirely possible that somebody can be knocked out and, you know, by basically hyperflexion of the jaw, the mechanism behind the TKOs we see in boxing or the knockouts we see in boxing. But oftentimes they then hit their head on the way down. You know, they might break their neck. They might have bleeding inside of their head. If somebody just has a concussion, you know, they can have life-altering consequences. A friend of mine got headbutted by a four-year-old. And this is a true story. Got headbutted by a four-year-old, I think 4 or 5 years ago, and never lost consciousness, and still has symptoms of post-concussion syndrome. She still has trouble with executive function, still has trouble with, you know, prioritizing and making decisions, and still, you know, gets headaches, gets fatigued very quickly. All of that from one concussion. So, you know, we have this myth that, oh, you know, hit the bad guy over the head. Well, it doesn't actually work that way. And you know, I think that one in particular can be dangerous. I have heard case reports of, you know, little brother hits big brother over the head because they do it on TV all the time, and big brother has a brain injury.
Mm. You know? Yeah, I think those of us who are well and have not you know, had bad things happen in that way. You know, it's very hard to imagine, but I did psychology, so I did a bit about brain injuries, and it's just scary, like how that type of thing can, like there's nothing potentially visible and yet it's affecting your life. So I do want to talk about that recovery. Like you mentioned there, the 2 to 3 weeks with a drain on the chest, you know, often our characters do not have 2 to 3 weeks to sit around when they're trying to save the world. and I'm currently writing book 10 in my Arcane series. And I'm very aware that Morgan, my character, has like scars from old injuries. She's got burns. You know, she really shouldn't be off saving the world. but my story kind of, my timelines demand that she does. And I don't want to bore my readers as well. So how can we incorporate recovery in our timeline? So is it a case of, you know, the classic, whatever, the adrenaline pen in the chest, I'm gonna get going with a load of drugs, or should we try and look at the physical and mental aspects of recovery?
I definitely think there's a place for looking at the physical and mental aspects of recovery. I think, you know, depending on what you decide to do with her, looking at something that has a fairly short recovery time might be helpful for you. I think also looking at, you know, asking yourself the question of what if she can't? What if, you know, because of some injury, she can't do things the way she wants to? What is her option? What is the option for the story? And, you know, taking some time to explore that, you may come up with something that might, you know, exceed or be a little bit more creative than something like that. I think in terms of, you know, the EpiPen in the chest, I think Pulp Fiction lied to us all.
I was thinking of The Rock with Nicolas Cage when he's just been poisoned and he's got that big pen in his chest. I'm like, yeah, right. You mean, well, it, you know,
they're also playing with nerve gas and not using an antidote to nerve gas, which does exist. So there's that too. But, I think, you know, one of the things that I tried to do actually when I wrote a book called Blood on the Page, it's unfortunately titled Blood on the Page Volume 1. I'm not sure that there will be a Volume 2 because I have actually stepped back from the writing space a little bit. So I didn't intend that to be misleading. But one of the things I did with that book was, you know, I made basically an a la carte list for writers who want to incorporate injuries into their stories. And, you know, what a writer can do, find something that, you know, either injures a body part that they're looking for or has a recovery time that they're looking for. So that, you know, if you need your character back on their feet in 2 weeks, well, you know, to do this, you know, if you have 6 weeks, go ahead and break some bones, right? Because 6 weeks is the typical recovery time for a broken leg, versus, you know, something like a wrist sprain. You know, maybe break a character's offhand arm where, you know, she won't be able to carry anything as much. She'll be guarding that the entire time she fights. She'll be asking herself, am I going to be as effective? But, you know, have her go in, almost knocked my laptop off my desk. Have her go into the final battle, you know, physically unprepared or, you know, physically weakened, and asking herself, can I really defeat the villain, you know, while I have my arm in a sling?
Well, then specific question, just from a purely selfish aspect. So her main injury, like the most recent injury, was, you know, fighting demonic snake and kind of killing it with this chemical, which has burned her. So the, you know, demon blood has kind of burned her. So essentially she has burned, skin on both her legs. So obviously she's in pain, but like, what is the recovery on leg burns?
Well, it's going to depend on a few things. To be honest, in part, it's going to depend on your genre, whether you want, you know, whether you want her to be able to function or, you know, be so out of her mind, stoned on opiates. That's part of your genre and part of your choices as a writer. It depends on the depth of the burn. If it's, you know, second degree burns where it's blistering and all that, you know, you're looking at probably, you know, a few weeks to a few months, depending on the level of care, whether she gets hurt again, stuff like that. You know, whether you have decided that you want her to have, you know, a superhuman pain tolerance, and, you know, that she can just keep kicking ass with, you know, horrible pain from her burns on her legs. I wouldn't suggest going to third degree burns on that, because that is so deep that it has severed the nerves. So actually that area of a third degree burn doesn't feel pain. The areas around it do, because you always have a circle of second degree around a third degree. Mm. But, you know, third degree burns definitely require hospitalization. The other thing is, depending on how much of her legs you've decided to burn, she's going to need quite a bit of fluid. She's going to be very, very thirsty for a few days. If she doesn't get official, you know, treatment, one of the things that happens with burns is you lose a lot of heat through the skin. You have a lot of tissue swelling in that area, blisters. And sorry, graphic content warning for your audience, but blisters wind up rupturing all the time, stuff like that. So there's a fair amount to consider in terms of that injury. And there's a fair amount to consider in terms of keeping consistent with your story and what you've already written. Mm. You know, this is, you said this is book 10 in a series of 10. Do you want to break the rhythm that you've already established to lend that piece of realism? And if you do, what's the point of it? So I think the number one question to ask yourself is, what is the point of giving her those burns?
It's so funny, because I think as writers, like when I was writing that, I actually thought maybe that was the end of the whole series. And I didn't even consider incorporating recovery. And I've done this before as well with Crypt of Bone. And I've done it before and then realized I've painted myself into the corner with injuries. And then I've had to figure out how to bring my characters back, even though they didn't necessarily die. It's kind of a big thing. But I really like what you're saying around using the injury to help us feel more empathy for the character, whatever their situation. And in that way, like I was thinking what you're saying about Bond, the Bond that people appreciate the most, I think, is Skyfall, where you know, Judi Dench dies, M dies, and you see his family history, and you see him grieving for her. And it's kind of like the injuries there, that the recovery is so much more part of it. And I now like the idea of making Morgan's pain part of it, rather than just her getting up and being completely fine.
I mean, let me ask you something. Mm. So first of all, when it comes to Skyfall, is that's the movie where he gets horribly tortured while he's sitting in a chair, and the end of the movie is him in recovery?
I can't remember. I know the scene with him.
I know
the chair.
It's one of them. Yeah.
But yeah, I can't remember if that's the one. But it's the one where they go back into his family home in Scotland, and it's just a much more personal film.
Yeah, no. And I think that's, of all of the Bond films, that's the one that's spoken to me the most as well, because he stops cartoon and he starts being a man. And I think that is crucial in, you know, emotionally connecting to a story. I think the other Bond films, you know, especially from the 60s and the 70s, you know, we watch because it's a good time. It's a romp. Even if it's a violent cartoony romp, you know, you have somebody who's trying to end the world with, you know, with a satellite. Like, okay. You know, but when you connect with the emotional and physical pain of the story of someone like Bond, that's when you get people really interested in the character. And I think that movie, of all of them, did the best job of making him real and relatable and a person, and not just, you know, a role. Mm. What to do with Morgan Sierra? My question is, are you starting book 10 right where book 9 left off? Can you put some time in between?
No, this is the thing. I've totally painted myself into the corner.
Oh, no.
By saying there's a body being found in New Orleans with these markings on, and I put that at the end about a year ago, and now I'm like, oh, okay, so there's my start. And unfortunately it's like that, you know, straight away. But I like what you're saying, and I'm going to incorporate that. So book is called Valley of Dry Bones. I haven't written it yet, but if people are listening to this
in the future, then
in the future,
yeah, they can decide whether or not I've managed. I have one last question because we're out of time.
Of course.
No. I'm interested in, and I talked a bit about this with Michael Brent Collins around humor and depression. I feel that humor and violence are also something that people struggle with. So, you know, yourself as a medical professional and the people you work with, is there this dark humor that comes into your job and into your writing because you can only laugh sometimes, otherwise you would cry? Like, is that a real thing? And what kind of humor is acceptable in these situations?
I mean, absolutely, that is a thing. You know, dark humor as a coping mechanism is a tried and true part of healthcare. And it's actually something that I've backed away from over the last few years in my career, where, it's something that newer people tend to lean on because they're processing their own emotions. Once you get square internally with things that are happening, hopefully you grow to a place where you don't need that as a coping mechanism, and you get to sort of relax and, think about it more in terms of the global context. So, you know, stop laughing at, the sort of less appropriate humor and start really leaning into, okay, but what can I do to help? Okay, but, you know, what is the actual meaning surrounding this? That's been part of my journey. It's been a part of the journeys of people that I've sort of helped to mentor over the years as a provider. But it's not necessarily something that I know how to handle in a writing context. I think whether or not to use humor and the type of humor to use is going to depend a lot on A, you as the writer, and B, on the characters involved. So some characters are going to have a really good sense of humor. Their method of coping with something that happens to them is going to be humor, or they're going to tease somebody into trying to get up and recover using humor. I think you can also be very destructive and very detrimental with humor. Mm. And I, you know, one of the things that I've always tried to walk the line with talking about all of this is respecting, you know, the community of people out there who are disabled, who, you know, either have had some kind of injury or, you know, have just chronic disability in general. And I think one of the best things you can do as a writer is, if you're going to make jokes in a particular space, ask somebody familiar with it. You know, and reach out to, writers and people who are out there helping. So one of the things we haven't had time to go into is the ethics of using torture. And there's a Tumblr blog that actually deals with this specifically of, you know, torture in storytelling and what the tropes are versus what the reality is and how to navigate that successfully. You can, you know, find all kinds of blogs on disability or on the LGBT community or on a whole bunch of things. There was actually a whole community of bloggers that I was a part of when I was actively blogging, that our mission was helping people navigate writing respectfully about various parts of life and writing about them accurately at the same time. So I think, you know, taking that level of responsibility as a writer and understanding that your words and your stories don't just affect your characters, they affect the larger conversation in that space about injury, disability, you know, queer communities, marginalized communities such as disabled people, things like that. And, you know, reaching out and finding out how those communities want to be seen, what they want in terms of representation. You know, and bring that. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we can do as storytellers is start to look at our stories as, you know, pieces of a broader social message and the ethics of how we approach telling our stories.
Yeah, I agree. And I really hope that the you know, the indie world makes this easier. And that's, you know, and I absolutely respect the fact there is an LGBT section on the bookstores. But I also feel that there should be, you know, LGBT characters in the other genres where it doesn't, you know, they're not actually put in like a separate category. It should just be, you know, or things like African-American category. It's like, seriously, can we... Yeah. Why can't we just, like, why isn't this just a thriller or a crime novel? Or, you know, I feel like the lines are changing in a way, but those characters should, you know, are just characters in other genres. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, including characters from other perspectives in any particular piece of fiction is, you know, one of the things we can do to just normalize people as people. You know, when I read a story about a lesbian character, I don't want it to be about her being a lesbian. I want her to have kick-ass adventures and go kiss some ladies. Like, come on. You know, same thing with a trans character. I don't want to hear this, the story of transition and all of that, although that's incredibly important. I want to hear about the moral choices that character is going to make and the, you know, how that character is going to move forward, you know, after facing difficulty after difficulty. So I think in terms of, you know, categorizing, instead of telling LGBT stories, we need to tell stories with LGBT people. And there's a big difference in those two. And I agree with you that we need to recategorize and take a good hard look at how we include people and how we include backgrounds in any particular piece of fiction.
Absolutely. Right. This has been really fascinating. So where can people find you and your books online?
So the easiest place to find me is scriptmedicblog.com. That will have links to everything. But in terms of Twitter, I am at scriptmedic, little play on words on script doctor. And if you want to, you know, if you're interested in checking out the books, go on Amazon, search under Samantha Keel, and I should pop right up.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Sam. That was great.
Thank you, Joanna. I'm so happy to be here.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Samantha today, and I definitely appreciated her comments on making my character Morgan Sierra's injuries part of the story. So Valley of Dry Bones will definitely have an impact there, and I hope the interview today gave you some food for thought as well. So next week, I'll be talking to Christopher Downing about Foolproof Dictation, which is a great book and another method of dictation, and a topic I know many of you are fascinated with, including me. I keep coming back to dictation. So Christopher's methodology, I think, is fascinating. So have a wonderful writing week, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.